It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Crazy kids, that's us.
Good morning.
We have to start these. We have to call Hezzy earlier. We get in these conversations about health and going on and this and that. And then this lady comes on and says, your show will go live in 5 seconds. So we like to terminate our conversation too quick. But
yeah, it's lovely to be able to talk to you, Hezzy, but it's also lovely to talk to our regular listeners. Thank you always for tuning in. We hope we brighten your day.
I dressed up for the show today.
Johnny dressed up. He's
in my white shirt.
As our listeners can see, right, Johnny?
Yes, my jacket. I have my jacket over here, just so.
He looks great.
I ask you a question.
I look professional for these kinds of things.
And as far as I'm concerned, my hair is pulled back because I need to shampoo it, and I'm not wearing any makeup.
Well, that's all right. You know, I got to ask you, though, is your secret to life and good relationship that all has to do with cars? Does it run around the cars? Is there anything that about car reviews that actually make it work?
No.
No?
Having two offices makes it work.
Oh,
hers is upstairs,
gosh.
Mine is downstairs.
That is terrible. No,
I've been thinking too hard. My apologies.
Yeah, you're trying to. You're stretching. You're reaching out there, Peacock.
Listen, the one thing about cars that does not work in our favor as a couple is when I or Johnny backseat drive, and I have learned to lick that problem. Johnny has not, but
Hey, I don't ever backseat drive when I'm driving.
That's right, you don't.
Yeah,
but
that solves the problem every single time.
But I'll tell you how. Really, this is almost like something out of The Taming of the Shrew, because the only thing that Johnny and I ever have really, you know, disagreed about, or actually that he's ever kind of blown up over, is my backseat driving. Well, that's because, obviously, I've been driving for a really long time.
Not as long as me.
Well, that's because you're, you know, slightly older than I. But the thing is, what he would do would be like Petruchio reaction. So I would say something, you know, very gentle, like, you missed your turn. And
yeah. Yeah, such a gentle way of saying that.
And that he would turn beet red, pull over to the side of the road, and get out of the car. So what happened was, that's a Petruchio reaction. I should use that as a phrase. Because what happened is he overreacted to the fact that, yes, indeed, he had overshot a turn, and I was right. But he was angry because I told him how to drive. So what I've learned is a Katerina approach, if you're all familiar with The Taming of the Shrew. If not, you really should at least see the movie with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. If not, read the Shakespearean play. But what I've learned to do is just, you know, bat my eyelashes and say, you're right. That turn came up too early, or it was the turn's fault, or something.
I don't remember any of this part, to be honest.
but every time you stare into Laurie's eyes and you see Elizabeth Taylor, you're a lucky dude.
Hey, amen.
Well,
amen. No argument there.
I do believe we share a couple
of
things.
But when I do that, I have a very good chance of running off the road, so I try to, like, focus when we're driving.
We do actually have
only
to
look into
eyebrows.
Her eyes at home.
Yeah.
And yes, you're right. Then I see Elizabeth Taylor smiling back at me.
Yeah, there you go.
Or actually Lily. I see our granddaughter through.
Oh, this is a sweetie. But in any case, so today, for our listeners who are now bored silly by what we've already just said,
well,
we're going to
bored silly. This is like, what's that show we watch every evening?
Oh, As Time
Goes
By.
As Time Goes By. This is what real people do, you know. It's not,
a very dear friend of ours told us that her favorite show was As Time Goes By, and we kind of, it's a British half-hour comedy. You can see it on BritBox, and Marilyn would say, this is my favorite show. It's so much like my marriage was. Her husband is deceased, but in any case, so one night we couldn't figure out what to watch, and we said, well, let's try this, and this is years after Marilyn told us the show, so we switched on. We are addicted to it. We watch it. We watch two episodes every night before bed.
And it is like a married. It's just like
it is
a married couple.
It's
really interesting.
It's a lovely show.
Yeah, sort of see yourself. I can certainly see myself in the
as time goes by with Judi Dench and what is that wonderful actress name?
I have no idea.
She died recently, and it's on BritBox, and it's about a couple who had met when they were young during World War II, and she was a nurse. During the Korean War. He was a soldier going off to war. She was a nurse. His letters got signed. She thought he forgot about them, him. And 38 years later, they reconnect by coincidence, and then they end up marrying. And it's she had been widowed, and he had been divorced. It's a lovely, lovely, very gentle show. And so I guess we're bringing this subject up. Why, Johnny? Because you know, an answer, I suppose, in a backwards way.
Because the things when we talk about life, we're talking about real life. And it is, you know.
And our marriage, no, it's not based on cars. In fact, cars are probably the least to do we have in common, share in common. And we you know, we definitely, you know, share so much in common.
We work.
No. We got to get to the Toyota Camry.
We are.
But I want to say this much. Every morning, Johnny gets up and he grinds fresh coffee beans from a mixture that he creates himself from several roasts that he's developed over time, which is sensational and better than any Starbucks on earth. And every morning he gets up, he grinds and he brews me a fresh coffee and brings it to me. That's how I start my day. And I got to tell you, Johnny and I are married 8 years now, going on nine, and nobody ever did this in my entire life before Johnny and I married. And actually, the coffee thing only happened a couple of years ago, but still, it's an example of the one most important thing in any marriage, which is that you are friends. And you and Johnny and I are best friends, and we discuss everything, we share everything, we are very, very blessed. But I think that if we had not been as loving and respectful as we are, and I guess an older marriage was. I mean, I was, what was I, honey? I was 59, and you were 63 or 64. We brought with us a whole history, you know, from elsewhere.
Baggage, that's called.
Yeah, baggage, history. I call it a history. and so we had to learn how to be a couple. And with that came the
we never owned the Buick.
Right, but with that, would you get? I'm trying to be very, you know, poignant here. But what we did do is we were friends before we were, you know, married. We were, and we knew we had a friendship. And the friendship, I mean, the sex is great, but the friendship, the friendship is the thing.
Notice
that,
I'm being quiet.
Yeah,
now.
You better be quiet. The friendship is what really carries, I think, a marriage, especially, you know, in the second act of life. So, yeah. So, no, cars are very minimal in what we do. We, you know, we've got it in science, though. How we drive cars, how we review cars, what we look for in cars has pretty much, 8 years now together doing this has fit a format. It's a kind
of evolved. That's evolved.
It has.
Yeah.
But and it's evolved just like the car industry's evolved. We've evolved as cars have evolved. My gosh. I mean,
It's very interesting because, you know, I have a 2010 Ford Edge, and we've been, 10 to 21? That's 11 years, and we've been married going on 9 years. And when the first car that I ever was able to drive after I married Lori was a Porsche, not 911, but one of the Porsche sports cars. And it was so foreign. I mean, I'd had sports cars when I was much younger, but it was so foreign to anything that I was used to driving. It was like I couldn't get over it. But when I look at that car and the subsequent cars that we had years ago, and you look at the cars that we review today, the difference in all of those is it is truly like night and days. We thought those were great cars, or I did, thought those were great cars 9 years ago. But there's no comparison to those cars, even mine, which was a 2008. There's no comparison to my vehicle, which is a wonderful vehicle, and the cars that we drive today. Simple things. And again, this actually has to do with the Camry, but the simple thing, rear view cameras. surround cameras that see everything. Cameras, or at least the radar system that keeps you from bumping into something in the front. Things that look for pedestrians. Things that keep you from opening the door in traffic. Things that keep you from backing up into traffic are now standard pretty much across the industry. And, of course, those are safety features, which is my big thing, to keep people out of accidents. And then the crumple zone, that was on the Camry. It's one of the things that I talked about in it, that the design now is such that not only do they have airbags and do they have all these things to avoid you getting in an accident, but they also have the things that if you're in an accident, they're trying to protect you. Crumple zones, so that if you're hit from the front or from the back, literally the frame of the vehicle is sort of an accordion effect to absorb the blow and keep the passengers and the driver safe, you know, to protect them in that, make them an insular type of thing. Of course, you got airbags and all the rest of it, but just, it's amazing. We're talking about 10 years. It's amazing the safety things, the safety features that have been added to all, I can't think of any that haven't, to all of the vehicles that are available to the public today. It's amazing, and it's a wonderful thing.
It is, and here's another observation. I think you'll agree with me, Johnny and Hezzy, and that's, you know, we used to talk about European styling, but now I would call it universal styling. I don't even think I'd call it European anymore, because when we look at, for example, the car we're about to talk about, the 2021 Toyota Camry.
We are talking about.
Which we are talking about. this car, you could say, has European styling, but it's...
Sort of.
But that's, yes. But there are two things that have changed almost continuously over the past decade, and that are grills and wheels.
Yeah, that's true.
But a sedan
is a sedan and a truck is a truck, so what are you going to do with it? You can make it bigger, smaller, and change the looks on the outside.
And then the line.
Yeah.
The line, and that's the styling. But let's roll right off the with the 2021 Camry, honey.
Well, and we got this from, what's Jennifer's company? Business?
Jennifer Harper.
Yeah, what's the business?
Oh, good Lord. I know it. Just give me a second.
All right.
But
Jennifer, we were short a vehicle. We needed a vehicle, and of course these things happen. And Jennifer was wonderful.
Drive Shop.
Yeah, Drive Shop, and they're out of Charlotte, aren't they?
Well, Drive Shop's a whole national car distribution company that distributes cars from the manufacturer to the press. That's what they do.
But Jennifer and her husband John are based
out of Charlotte.
And she got us this 2021 Camry. She wanted us to kind of review it. And so in looking about, getting all the information about the Camry, which, you know, anybody can get online, by the way, and most of my reviews, other than the personal things that I get from riding around the car and evaluating, you know, all the things that's, you know, performance, its comfort, its quietness, which are the things that, you know, what we think it looks like. But the rest of it you get from, you know, looking at either the Maroni, which tells you the price of that particular car and all its features, or you get it from the Internet. I mean, you go to Toyota and you look up the cars and you see what they say about the car that we're driving, and you sort of evaluate it based on whether you think that's accurate or not. And one of the things, sorry, I'm getting all kinds of phone calls. But one of the things, Lori, let's start with styling. And when you look at the front of this car, I don't think it looks European. It looks more, and I don't know what exactly the right word is, but it looks more like a spaceship. I mean, it's just got that, it's got some very strong angles to it. And it's very sharp. And again, it goes back to the Dick Tracy things when they would talk about the future and the vehicles and all that.
Actually,
kind of stuff.
You're right about the Dick Tracy thing. I can see that.
Yeah, but listen.
But sleek. They're not. It's, I don't
well,
call
it's
it
different.
Angular. It's very sleek.
Okay, But I can tell you, you recognize, once you drive one, once you're around one, you'll recognize every one of them that you see on the road.
Now
you'll know that that's
I've got to interrupt. This is just too good. I want to bring up a subject we have not discussed in a long time, and that's the color of the car.
Oh, we got a red one for a change.
Yes, we did. But here's the thing that's interesting. I don't know that I've ever seen any car model with as many color options as I have with this car. There are 13 color options, but they're all either shades of gray or red, or black or white. But here's the thing. Of those 13, and this is interesting, 4 are dual tone. Okay? So you've got 9 that are solid, and you've got 4 that are dual tone, such as...
Two-tone.
Such as supersonic red and mid-black metallic. And the accent color is the black metallic, and it's the roof and the rear spoiler. So here we've got 13 color options, and I don't think I've known anyone that has had more.
Well, and you're just starting, because the Camry line, this is a very interesting thing, I think, about Toyota. The Toyota Camry has 12 models, 12 different models. And it starts with, it was in my write-up, but I've got it right here.
Camry Hybrid at $25,000, is that the first one?
No. Let me tell you, just hold on.
The LE model.
Yeah, the Camry LE. Now listen, a Camry LE, starting model, 5-seater, sedan. Touchscreen, 17-inch wheels, 28 miles to the gallon, 39 miles to the gallon on the highway, $25,000. We'll talk about the warranties and stuff in a minute.
Yeah, but
$25,000 just to start, and then go to the hybrid, which is the second model, 51 and 53 miles per gallon, $27,000. $27,000 for a hybrid that gets 50 miles.
52 average miles a gallon. Unbelievable.
It is. It really is unbelievable. Well, and the thing that I wrote in there, you start with the LE and then you go all the way over to the highest end.
Let's keep going. The SE.
Okay, you keep going.
Okay, the SE starts at a little less because it's not a hybrid. It's a plain gas model. But that starts at 26 and it has... The extra, you know, the specially trimmed seats, the extra front grille.
Every time you go up, you get whatever was in the model before and something else.
So the SE is $26,000 and change, and that gets 29 miles to the gallon. Next is the SE Hybrid. Now we're back up on the mileage thing. 45, 46 miles average per gallon. Incredible. Starting at 29, a little under $29,000. Now we go to the SE Nightshade Edition, which starts at $27,000 and change, getting 28 miles city and 39 miles highway. And now we're back up to the next level, XLE, which is a gas car, 27 city, 38 highway with heated and multi-stage front seats, leather trimming, 9-inch touchscreen, audio, da-da-da. Going up again, the XLE Hybrid, average of 45 miles a gallon, with all those features that we saw in the XLE. That starts at still $32,000. I mean, look at what we're getting here. We go back to the XSE. That's the next model. Again, it's a gas.
And that's what we had, was an XSE.
Which starts at $30,000.
And I think ours was like $32,000 because we had all-wheel drive. That was the big feature on ours.
That was the big feature. And the estimated mileage is 38 highway. I mean, still phenomenal. I think we did better than that, actually.
Yeah.
Then the next one up, XSE Hybrid. So now we're back up to 45 miles a gallon with all the perks of the XSE. Now we go up another notch, another model, the TRD, which gets to city 31 highway, but this one has a little extra fine finishing, a gloss black front splinter, and special side skirts. It's
more of a racing.
Right?
Yeah, it's more the racing division. TRD usually stands for Toyota Racing Division, so it's got a
And then now we're on the XLE V6. Now we've got a V6 engine, still $35,000 starting price.
Hold on a minute. That TRD had a V6 too. I think that's the first one.
It did. It had a V6.
And that's what gets it into the racing division. You've got a bigger engine, the double overhead cam, and then you got these racing things. Now go to the XLE.
Okay, and that's, again, that's the same deal as the TRD. It's got the V6 24-valve DOHC engine, but it also has, which the TRD didn't have, a panoramic glass roof with front power tilt side moonroof. Okay, and it's got this really pumped up audio system. Okay, so these are, oops, there's even more.
No, there's one more, and yeah, it's a
XSE V6, top of the line at $35,620.
Stop.
MSRP.
Stop. This is a point that I think we have to make. The top-of-the-line Toyota Camry is only just a touch over $35,000, which is basically affordable for any family that works. If you're working, you could probably afford this car. And if you need a sedan, and a good sedan, it's going to be hard to beat at that kind of money.
And here's something that underscores everything we've just discussed, Donnie, and that's this. The Toyota Camry has been in existence one way or another since 1955, all right? That is
a long time.
That's more than a half a century.
Well, what did you say, 55?
55.
55 to 2000 would be 45 years, 65, 66 years.
Okay, so 66 years. This car,
you ought to be getting it right by now.
In one way or another, it's been in existence. Exactly. So what they have done is they found a formula that they built upon. Now, originally it was a much narrower car. Of course, it didn't have all the perks and whistles we've got today. But it has, in one way or another, evolved for over six decades. So what this says to us is they haven't, pardon the pun, reinvented the wheel. What they've done is they've built upon a sound foundation, and that's the Camry.
They just keep making a better wheel.
And as you pointed out, honey, this V6 for $35,000 and change, that's unbelievable.
That's the things, and when we talk about Kia and we talk about Hyundai, we talk about Toyota, they've made affordable vehicles. They've made vehicles that Americans can afford to own and drive. Which I think is great. I want to tell a little story here. I've always been a big Toyota supporter. You probably don't know that, but I had three Toyota trucks. I was and still am a big supporter of a Toyota Tacoma. I just absolutely loved them. I had a green one with an extended cab. This was a long time ago. And that was back when I had sort of a career on the Eastern Shore doing a lot of hunting stuff and plus business things, but loved it, drove it for, several years, and then traded it in on a crew cab. Had four doors because I needed more space to put things, not people, just things, and I always loved a truck. So I had that one, and I drove it for I put about 100,000 miles on it, and then basically sold it, gave it to my youngest son, who then put a lot more miles on it, and then he, I think, traded it in. But when I did that with him, I bought another one, a newer model, and but the same crew cab, four-door truck, and loved it. And the reason that I actually traded it in was not because I didn't like it or anything, but because that was right about the time I hit my stride in going up and down the coast to do all these shoots and shows where I was an exhibitor, and I needed to carry a bunch of things, TVs, video things, tables, backdrops, all the things that you have to have when you're doing exhibitions. And I needed all that, but I needed it where I could just put it in, take it out, where it was easy, and it was covered, and it was lockable. And if you can put something on a truck and put a cover on a truck, and I've had those before. But it's not easy to get things out of the the front of the bed of the truck. So it just made more sense to go to what was then called an SUV or a crossover. I guess that's what I got, was a crossover, and that's why I went to that. But I have nothing, and I mean nothing, but positive things to say about the Toyota trucks I had. They were exceptional, and just like we talked about, great mileage, great ride. And the true of this Camry, quiet, comfortable, excellent ride, great handling, sunroof, which I never use. I'm not one of those, especially this time of year. People open the roof when they're driving around, but, you know, it just gets my head burned. I don't have enough hair up there anymore to stop the sunburn, so I don't really use that kind of thing. But it's, you know, for people that like it, I mean, it's attractive. It is not something that I would get if I were ordering the car. It's not something that I would pay extra for or even pay for if I had to. I'd rather do without it. But safety, all of the safety things that we've talked about, plus all the other ones that you can imagine would be on this kind of vehicle, lane keep assist, lane departure warning, emergency braking. If, you know, it looks like you're going to be in an accident, it monitors the cars in front of you. It slows you down. If you move over and the lanes are open, it speeds back up. I mean, it's doing all those things, those steps that are always getting us closer to autonomous driving. So it has all of those kinds of things. Great interior, big screen for the navigation and for the radio and split, all of that kind of thing. So you have multiple things going on. Gear shift where it's supposed to be, cup holders where they're supposed to be. It had the space in front of the gear shift where you just laid your phone, so it charges your phone. I think that was an extra, too, as you get up in the various values of the cars. Those are kind of things they add on. What else, hon, can you think of that?
Well, I just want to concur that it felt it was more than just the drivability. You'd go in this car, everything was where it belonged. All the controls are where you expected. They didn't, you know, kind of reinvent the dashboard. Very, very quiet, very easy to drive, everything you'd expect. But what I'd like to say is, having just stated that when Toyota got it right with the Camry, one thing that they didn't get right, and this is just a personal, very personal opinion, is when they then built upon the classic Toyota Land Cruiser FJ40 to create the Land Cruiser that they have today, which bears no resemblance whatsoever to the original FJ40, which was a takeoff of the World War II vintage Jeep, which I owned, the 1971 model, and among the many regrets in my life is the fact that I sold it. And right now, if I wanted to get exactly what I had back in 1971, I would have to fork out for a restored version about $50,000. And this really bothers me because I bought it for like $4,000. New. This car...
Hey, let me just interject this. The first pickup truck I bought, was $3,000. And it was a doozy. I mean, it was an 8-foot bed and the right wheels and, you know, automatic. No, it wasn't automatic. It was a 3-speed, I think. But $3,000. And you look what trucks cost today.
And here's the thing. The Toyota FJ40 was noisy, difficult to drive. You had to get out to turn the hubs.
Yeah, I remember those.
You wanted to go into four-wheel drive or if you were in the snow or whatever. It was. It had no suspension whatsoever. The back seats were sideways. They were that you put them up against the side of the inside of the vehicle if you wanted extra storage space. The seats were totally uncomfortable. I adored this car, and I'll tell you, I've now determined that my dream vision is to get another one.
I had a big Blazer once upon a time.
But honey, isn't that funny how you think when you know?
So it's what I was going to say, because I had a big Blazer, the K5, the old K5s, and you had to get out and lock in the hubs. But when you had to get out and lock in the hubs, you were in the mud, you were in the snow. You know what? You thought that was fun. You thought that was great. Look, I'm going to lock in these hubs, and I'm going to go. And we thought that was great stuff, you know.
Except when the hubs wouldn't lock us right shut. But, you know, the fact is that was maybe a part of our past. I mean, it doesn't have any kind, it had like an AM, FM radio.
Maybe oh, sure.
AM. It didn't have, you know. It,
FM was the big deal. Remember that?
Yeah, it was a big
FM, deal. Because it was mostly
music. No such thing as a screen. Mm-hmm. No such thing as, you know, anything of that kind of nature. No, no plug-ins for your cell phone. Nothing like that. But if I had to do it again, and I'd like to, I would get that car in a nanosecond. And why? Because it was part of my past, yes. But, and it's a term I haven't used for a long time, I was at one with the car. In other words, that car didn't drive itself. Didn't have all these comforts built in, nothing of that whatsoever.
Let me say one thing, can I, before we get out of here, because we're about to run out of time.
Right, you are. Go ahead.
The Camry has something I hadn't seen, but I know is worth having. It's called whiplash injury lessening. It's in the driver's and passenger seats, and it keeps you, it, the way it's said, it keeps you from getting whiplash. I had a car, got rear-ended, and I'm suffering from that today. Go see the chiropractor about every week or so now, simply because it hurt my neck. You're young, you don't think about it. Now I think about it all the time. Whiplash injury lessening. Things like that make a difference. We sort of pass over them, but they make a difference in the safety of a vehicle. Okay, we got to wrap it up, but I don't want to get that in there.
All right, Hezzy, you have a good week. We'll talk to you next week. Stay cool.
All the best.
Thank you, Ezzy. Talk to you later.
John. All right, buddy. Bye. All right. Well, our next guest is already on the line, none other than Brian Harrod. He's the publisher and editor of Yonkers Newswire. Good morning, Mr. Brian Harrod. How are you?
How you doing, Ezzy? Your previous guests are so informative. I love listening to them every week. They know their cars.
They're fun.
Yes.
They are fun to listen to on Thursdays, for sure.
Sounds like they've owned every vehicle in the history of automotive manufacturing, I guess, in the U.S. and internationally.
Yeah, absolutely. A long history. And then Lori was one of the first people that was involved with a Volvo at that time, years and years and years ago. Yeah, she was like one of their top, drivers, and she knows that car in and out. Phenomenal.
Mm.
Great history. Yes. And
you always have great guests.
There are no bad cars nowadays. Well, tell us what went on. There's a lot of stuff that's been going on in Yonkers, you know, that raid. Oh, my God. It's such a good neighborhood, too. What's going on? Do we know who those people are and what they did?
I saw a social media post. One lady, I think she was an author of a book. Apparently, there's two apartments in that house.
Uh-huh.
And apparently, they hit both apartments for some reason. And they had an armored vehicle that, like, shoved the car into the garage. They blew the doors off. Two apartments came in and detained a handful of people, and I think eventually took one in custody. And I believe it's a firearms violation from this FBI task force. They have I don't know what the violation is. There hasn't been much put out, but the they got one person. It's a firearms violation, and then they shut down the streets. And it was apparently it was like combat there for a second. Not that there was any fire towards the police, but they were just taking extra precautions, I assume. But they left a mess. They had to leave a police car out in front of the place because the garage door was pushed in, and the front doors on two apartments were blown off their hinges.
Mm. Well, evidently, but we don't really know why they broke down the doors. Like, do we know what the rationale is?
I'm told, unless I've been misinformed, I'm told it's a firearms violation. Apparently, this FBI has these task force, 160 of them across the country. And in New York, there's one in Buffalo, Albany, New York City, and there's one in Westchester. And I guess they got it, but this person had a gun or had some kind of gun or that. Maybe because, I don't know what type of gun or what it was to cause such a response, but there's been a lot of pressure on the Yonkers Police Department because there's been so many gang assaults, so many gang shootings, so many gang stabbings, and you had the young youth kid that stuck his gun out the car and shot four people. Then just before that, there was a little six-year-old boy that had gotten shot, and there was just so many of these shootings that perhaps the Yonkers Police Department was able to develop a tip that you know, someone had a firearms violation, and that brought in the FBI task force. I guess I don't know. I'm just speculating, but but it was substantial.
I'm wondering. I usually when it's so hot, I usually read about cooling centers in Yonkers. Have we opened the cooling centers?
I understand that for homeless people, they may have. For the ladies, might be able to go to the YWCA or stay in their rooms during the day and not be thrown out. And the same with the men's shelter on Palisade, that instead of just pushing everybody out, they're allowed to stay at the shelter because it's so hot. I know a lot of seniors were upset because they wanted the community centers to open up like they usually do. But for some reason, the city didn't open it. I don't know. At the last minute, yesterday, they started saying the libraries were available for cooling, you know, that you could come into the library if you had a mask, but the three branches. Mm-hmm. But I guess for some reason, the community centers won't be available until July 12th. But, you know, so I guess if you're a senior and you can't afford to run air conditioning 24/7 or don't have air conditioning, or because you're on a fixed income type of thing, these places were not available this time around for some reason. It was quite a heat wave
very,
too.
Very
it was a scorcher.
It's been a brutal summer, and we're expecting unbelievably hot weather. Really, very very high, above the norm. And
hopefully,
so
Yonkers
we'll
will
see
be
how that goes.
They'll be more prepared, I guess, for the next heat wave if there is another. You know, I guess there will be another one, but they should. In my opinion, they should have the every community center open in each of these neighborhoods. If you for some reason you can't be cool at your home or you're on the street because you know it's a preventable death if you die of a heat stroke.
Yeah, unbelievable. You know, one thing that I did find interesting, evidently your firm, you had applied for information from the police department, and they want to charge $30 a page to photocopy.
It's not me. I was reporting on
misconduct
it.
Misconduct records?
It was a group called Muckrake. They had applied. Previously, Gannett had applied to get records and had been stalled by the police department right after the 50-A public records law went into effect that used to shield police disciplinary records from the public.
Right.
And now Muckrake has tried to do it, and Yonkers apparently has 1,000 pages, which is an awful lot of misconduct. You know, you're talking, you know, a ream of paper. You know, you go to buy a ream of copy paper, that's 500 pages, so two reams of paper. And normally the fee for a Freedom of Information request is 25 cents a page, but Yonkers is saying that the Yonkers commissioner is saying he wants 30 bucks a page. And, you know, it makes it difficult to pay 30,000 bucks. But it's a shame. I'll put it to you this way. You have the Yonkers PBA president defending a detective who went and was cursing at and saying derogatory things to a black suspect that was, you know, was not resisting and basically got his face plowed in with sucker punches and then he got his face shoved into the ground like a mini Derek Chauvin. And our PBA president was defending that person, but it turns out he has 17, and New Rochelle's not doing what Yonkers is doing. He has 17 previous, like, misconduct complaints. So it shows that there's some kind of pattern there with this, I believe his name is Detective Vaccaro. But in Yonkers, we want to hide that information from people. You know, the commissioner is choosing to hide that information. It's not the PBA president who chooses it. It goes to the records access officer, and then the chief of police is in charge of the records access officer, and he's basically saying, I'm not going to follow the law in New York State. I'm not going to provide these records. And in New York, these records, too, they said if a Freedom of Information request or a FOIL request, if it's been already digitized, they're not supposed to charge for that record. So I assume each of these police complaints have been, like, email to attorneys, email to other officials within the police department. And once it's digital, there's no copying fee. You just basically say, you just send it by email. You know what I'm saying? So there's not supposed to be a fee on a Freedom of Information request that involves no copying. You know what I'm saying? But they're trying to say, well, you know, we have to pay a police officer to go to go in the computer under this file folder and send these documents over to this muckrake nonprofit organization, this journalistic organization. So I guess it's going to have to go to court, and we're going to have to find out why the Yonkers Police Department wants to violate the law. You have the commissioner saying, telling young African-American people, be the change, help reform the Yonkers Police Department, and then when it comes time for the commissioner to stand up and to be the change and to bring police reform to Yonkers, oh, no, you know, you want the records on this police officer? He's got 20 complaints. That's $30 a page. I need $600. And then if you do come up to $600, you're probably not getting the record because it's just trying to put up a defense or an excuse not to give you the records. And then these records should be available. People should know if there are rogue cops. People should know if there are cops misusing drugs. People should know if there's a cop that's consistently hurting people in the community. And that's vital information, I think, and it's public information. It's taxpayer-funded information. It doesn't belong to the commissioner. It belongs to the people of Yonkers. They paid for it. They paid for the computers that it was done on. They paid for the people that filled the reports. They paid for the people that investigated the incidents. They paid for the people that filed the reports. So why shouldn't they have access to the records they paid for?
That's a great question. How does this thing get resolved, though? Who needs to sue?
I think they have to go to court. I don't know if it's in Article 78 where you go before a judge in the Ninth District and say they're not doing the right thing, or if you have to go complain to the Secretary of State. You know, there's a committee for Freedom of Information requests that is supposed to help resolve these issues, and sometimes the state will sue on behalf if they have to, on behalf of somebody who wants to get a record.
You know offhand, Brian, if the Inspector General in Yonkers, if he could get involved to release this, because he knows what the law is. It's just that the police department evidently are.
He could, calling. But that would be you have the police a union. Actually, the police union is the one talking out on this and saying it's going to be $30 a page. But it's really the police union has no say in it, but they have an awful lot of influence over the commissioner. They have a lot of influence over, political elected officials. And so Liam could just step in and say, yes, release these records or do an investigation of why this is. You know, how can you charge $30 a page? But I don't see that happening. That's in the political realities of Yonkers.
I don't know what you think about, but like I know, for example, there are many people who are in politics. Well, certainly the union money helps tremendously to back up a lot of candidates for office, including judges, including people who in a sense, can make or break the rights of an individual. Because they lean one way or the other because they realize that they've been getting funding from a particular union. And so they're, you know, they say every man, forget about the women. Women don't have a price. So they're going to say, okay, forget it. I'll do whatever. But the men always seem to have a price. So you can buy a guy real easy Women, not so, even though we claim that we do, that they're loose, but they're not. The men are the ones that always have a price, and they let go. Why do we continue to allow unions to have influence over judges and people in elected office? Why is that permitted? Because
there's a lot of people who do complain that there's a lot of people who argue that there's a huge conflict of interest. You know, when you have a union providing major funding to people that decide what their contract terms are going to be, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, but then you have the unions that might try to argue, you know, it's freedom of speech, it's this or another, but maybe that donating of money should be limited so that it isn't an undue influence, you know, that unfortunately it's almost like a lot of dark money or a lot of PACs or a lot of pretty big payouts. And people do feel that there is an undue influence, and people won't stand up to a lot of reasons. Police reform came into the focus and been needed is because a lot of elected officials are afraid to stand up and speak out because it could mean that the police union puts funding for someone to remove them from that seat. You don't get many people that are elected officials in Yonkers speaking out about abuses in the Yonkers Police Department. You only get the media that's willing to speak up or people that have been abused in illegal situations that are willing to speak up. Mm. Or there might be a lawyer that takes on a lawsuit, but you don't really you see people giving lip service to police reform, but when something happens, you don't see people coming out and speaking out against it. When there's a surge in youth gang shootings, you don't see the politicians in Southwest Yonkers saying, this has to stop. This needs to stop right now. The police department needs a plan. The police department needs a strategy. And if that strategy doesn't work, they got to come up with another strategy. We don't need our children dying. We don't need our children shooting each other. You don't hear politicians saying that. You don't hear it from county legislators. You don't hear it from city council people. But one of the reasons
the police department has a lot
of money.
Yeah, they do. So why don't we have like local patrols? Why don't we have community patrols and we don't have enough people on the street. We have enough people in the police department, but they don't seem to know their communities very well. Which is a real problem.
Well, when they're out of town, it's similar to this problem here that it's been pointed out that this is a minority-majority community. This is a community of color in the majority.
Mm-hmm.
And the police department is over 90% white. And those people that are 90% white are from out of town, you know. And when it comes time every year to attract people in the community to be the change, as the commissioner claims he wants, they go and they advertise in Putnam County, they advertise in Rockland, they advertise in, you know, Pound Ridge and Rye Brook and all over the place, but they don't really focus on attracting people here. And we're going to see when they have this police test and when we have our first class of probationary officers, we're going to see how many officers of color are there, you know. And if it's one or two, I don't believe we should be all excited that, oh, they attracted two African-American or two or three persons of color, because at that rate, you know, the police department will probably be diversified maybe to reflect what the community is by the year maybe 2175. It's time for – there's a problem. These, you know, some guy that's living in Yorktown Heights – comes to Yonkers, he doesn't really know, you know, Nodine Hill that well, but and he doesn't really know people in that community really well. But, you know, if I'm a guy in Yorktown Heights and I want a career with in law enforcement, well, Yorktown's not really hiring a lot of officers, but Yonkers is.
No.
So they get a ton of people to apply and they flood. They had 2,400 applications from people just outside of Yonkers. They just flood the city with all these white applications.
You know, I don't know about if you know this, but in the past, they've always opened up these tests for everyone to take, mm-hmm. and they invite people from outside of Yonkers. They recently mm-hmm. said, well, they're going to show preference for people who reside in Yonkers. But the truth mm-hmm. is, in the past, if you applied from the Bronx, from upstate, up county, or wherever, mm-hmm. They didn't give you the job. They took your $100 application fee, and that's
yeah.
it. You never got hired. They didn't hire.
If Commissioner Mueller really wants to beat a change himself, and he wants young African-American Yonkers residents to come step up and beat a change, like he claims,
mm-hmm.
why don't he just limit this test to Yonkers? You know, you have to be a Yonkers resident if you're applying for this. And you know what? The majority of people are people of color. He'll get an awful lot of people of color applying for that, but no, he's going
right.
to go and market in Pleasantville. He's going to go market in Bedford. He's going to go market in Carmel and Garrison. And he's going to get a lot of people to apply. And his class of probationary officers are going to be mostly white, and the 90% white
mm-hmm.
force is going to be, going to be in policing basically minority-majority neighborhoods and a minority-majority city.
Well,
it does seem,
though, that the police department promotion for people of color to join the force in the next class is going to fail. We won't even get 60 people of color, I doubt
mm-hmm.
it. And that would make up, that's 10% of the entire 600 that are part of our police department.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, what's this all about? And why are we blowing money out the window advertising in places that nobody reads? The circulation
yeah.
is really from hunger, and we're not reaching them in the communities of color. And I
yeah.
don't understand why.
Well,
you know?
I've had in my groups and in on my website, I've had arguments with people because, you know, they go to front of Dunkin' Donuts in Getty Square and they hand out some flyers, and we did outreach to the African American community. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And then you get all these
mm-hmm.
people, a lot of times with fake accounts, mostly which look like they're kind of a tie to the police union because they're always constantly commenting on police issues and praising the police. That's almost, you know, they'll have
uh-huh.
no friends, and they're constantly like, great job, great job, great job. Oh, how can you say this? Blah, 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 blah. You know, do you, blah, 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 like this kind of stuff. And then when it comes time to do it, they say, we can't force the people to do it. It's not our fault if African-Americans don't want to apply. African-Americans want to apply. African-Americans in Yonkers want to be a part of the change. African-Americans are qualified and can do it, but they try to make this argument that they're not qualified, they're just too lazy, and they don't want to do it. And we had to take all these white officers from other communities in Westchester and the Hudson Valley. And that's just wrong. There are people here qualified to take that test if they're made to feel welcome. But you don't make people feel welcome when the commissioner's person goes and attacks an African-American congressman. When the African-American congressman spoke out about, you know, Keith Olson defending this detective that, you know, sucker punched a black guy multiple times in the face, shoved his face in the ground with a mini Derek
yeah.
Chauvin move and crushed his face in there, the Yonkers Police Department all of a sudden felt the need to drop a dime on the New York Post, hey, conservative media, we got a call from the Capitol Police Department to please keep an eye on Jamal Bowman's house because of this insurrection on January 6th. So we patrolled for a couple of weeks, but we decided it didn't really need protection because we live in the safest city. But Jamal Bowman, who's talking about police reform, wants the police.
Mm.
He needs the police. He's begging for police protection. Actually, it was the Capitol Police that suggested to the intelligence unit of the Yonkers Police Department that they should keep an eye on his house because he had been
mm-hmm.
outspoken about police reform. But
right.
now, when your police department is that politicized, where, you know, if a African-American congressman from Yonkers, you know, speaks out about police reform, and then not the police union – but the police community affairs officer that's supposed to be attracting African-American candidates here in the city of Yonkers is calling up the New York Post to trash this African-American congressman. Now, how welcome do you think African-American young men and women feel about joining the Yonkers Police Department after that?
It's absolutely absurd. It really is. I'm just in shock by this sort of behavior. And I don't understand why, if we want people of color from our community, why we can't have courses at other times of the year to train people of what they need to know in order to do these tests. So because there is an interest. And
we have a Boy Scout troop where we talk about law enforcement, and maybe some of those people might apply. So they feel like they have these little not very effective things that they say they do, like passing out flyers in front of Dunkin' Donuts in Getty Square. But the truth is, culture that Police Commissioner John Mueller has is not of welcoming young African-American men and women to come join the force and to come be this change that he claims he wants. Even when you have spoken out, you know, against wrongdoings in the police department, what did the commissioner and the police chief do? They want to take you to court and try to sue you for some ridiculous slap lawsuit for, what is it, $17 million, has he? This is not a culture of welcoming people in the community.
Yeah, that's what they're suing. I think it's only $7 million, you know, I guess.
Oh, $7 million, excuse me.
Only $7 million.
And it just, the whole idea was, we're going to try to silence a voice asking for reform in the police department. You know what I'm saying? Litigation that's just absurd. You know what I'm saying? And that is, and then you turn around and say, I want you to be the change. You don't want people to be the change if you're trying to silence anyone that speaks out about reform. If Jamal Bowman speaks out about reform, you don't want change if you're dropping a dime to – you're telling your community affairs officer, you know, to drop a dime at the New York Post, like to trash this person. You don't want change if you're suing media outlets that are calling for reform. You don't want change if you have – fake accounts coming on Facebook and saying all kinds of crap right and left, you know what I'm saying? It's not basically not even true. You don't want change when you want that. That's a culture of not welcoming African-Americans into the force and of maintaining a 90% white police force.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry to get
I don't
so
know
excited.
How much longer.
I'm going to have a heart attack one of these days.
No, don't. You got to calm down about that. But I understand the passion because that's what the city's been telling us for a long time. We just haven't been paying attention. The city has spoken many, many times, and they want change, but we're not getting it. And I don't know why there's a reluctance by this police commissioner to hold off. He says one thing, and yet he acts differently.
How can your head of your police union go down in front of everybody, 1,000 protesters, and take a knee and say, I want police reform? Then the minute that his stop-and-shake guy, Hector Santiago, makes one criticism about him, he's trying to pulverize the guy. You know what I'm saying? People are holding him back because he had a complaint. He had an idea. He had input, Hector Santiago had. But the police union president is just out of control. Or how can Jamal Bowman says, you know, you're not right about this, Keith Olson, defending this detective with 17 violations. He was acting in anger. He wasn't acting for the good of law enforcement or for the good of the community. He wasn't even on duty. And he sucker punched this guy and shoved his face in the pavement. And that's why the DA is going after him. And then what do they do? The commissioner who wants change, Dean, call up the New York Post. Let's talk about the guy that wants to defund the police and needs our police protection. They'll eat that up.
For Keith Olson to go after the district attorney is outrageous. First of all, she's investigating issues, and but they hate her for that. They hate her for the fact that she's going to be a credible Westchester County district attorney. They hate her for every issue, and they want to paint her to be the bad person, which she's not. And you know what?
Mm-hmm.
She was elected to office. Isn't that interesting? The electorate spoke. She won. She won over the prior incumbent, Scarpino. I'm not saying anything bad about Scarpino, but they felt that she was a better candidate, and she's proven.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it amazing that people are running after her to undermine her, to demonize her, to prejudge what she thinks and what she does? And guess what?
Mm-hmm.
She is the Westchester County District Attorney. I trust that she'll do the right thing, and there are always going to be other judges out there making sure she sticks to the straight and narrow. It's outrageous Mr. Olson is trying to do. Detective Olson is trying to do.
And
to
then
undermine
on top of all this, they want to charge $30 to email you a copy of a public record. You know what I'm saying? Because it's about police misconduct. You know, if I want to get a report, you know, of an accident, they'll probably just give it to me over the counter. You know what I'm saying? Or maybe they will charge me to quarter for it. You know what I'm saying? But if you want something from police misconduct, you want these three pages, that's $30 a page, that's $90. Even if you come up with the $90, you're not getting that. You know what I'm saying? Because they're choosing to violate the law.
Brian, forgive me. It's 11 o'clock and we've got another guest.
All right.
But how do people reach out to the Yonkers Newswire? How do they find you?
You can find it at yonkersnewswire.com and on Facebook. And I thank you for inviting me as a guest, Hezzy. You have a good day.
Thank you. I look forward to speaking to you next week. All the best. Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye now.
Bye. All right. Let's bring in our next guest, Brianna Worden. How are you, Ms. Worden?
Hello, I'm doing well. How are you?
I am so excited to be able to speak to you. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you.
I am just overwhelmed by your struggles in life. And you started at a very, very young age when you were diagnosed. And I don't know about you, and I don't know how far your memory goes, but I can guarantee you, even though I think I have a pretty solid mind now, I'm in my 70s, but the thing that's really fascinating is I don't remember what I was thinking or how it could direct myself at 2 years of age. Where did you find the strength to overcome the diagnosis that you were suffering?
I've definitely had a great support system. I think that's extremely important. I have a wonderful family and group of friends who have always supported me through thick and thin, regardless of what I was going through. And, of course, you know, the Children's Tumor Foundation as well. They help not only me, but millions of other individuals who have been impacted by this disorder. But, again, really my mom, she has taken me to all of my hospital visits. And without that support system, again, I would definitely not be where I am today.
Well, that's really very interesting. How did your mom get you to fight and struggle through the process? And we should tell people you were diagnosed with neurofibromatosis. NF
exactly,
type
you said
1.
And
it's supposedly it's regarded as an invisible disease. Why is that? Is it because it's so difficult to diagnose?
It's not just that it's so difficult to diagnose. So with NF, it can look so different with any individual. So mine, you can see that I have tumors in my left arm, but when you look at me, you wouldn't know that it encompasses my entire left side. So my tumors stem from my neck, around my chest cavity, my lungs, my kidneys. You can't see kidneys, obviously. So when you look at me, if I'm wearing a long sleeve shirt, you would never know that I'm covered in tumors and that I have also had cancer 3 times. And with other individuals, it can also be visible. So it can look knocked all over the skin. But it's more so explaining that we are all different. NF is different in everybody. No two people are the same, so that our pain is chronic, but it doesn't define who we are, but we still deal with extreme issues surrounding these tumors. You just can't see them all.
Mm-hmm. So from the age of 2 when you were diagnosed, you had support from your family, and But how do you get a child, you know, 2 years of age, to move through the process of aging in a manner that allows you to contend with your own medical issues and to strive for more and to keep on striving even though it's difficult? Or is your norm what you live through? And in a sense, it may have held you back, but you didn't know that there might have been an easier way if you didn't have this.
Right.
Is that the silver lining in a sense?
It is. Like, it's definitely held me back. There were times where, you know, it's kind of like a movie. I would look outside the window and see all of the other children playing, and I would wish that I could be, you know, like that. And I have brothers who are able to, I don't want to say able to do the normal things in life, but they were able to play sports and things like that, and I often watched them. But I liked being their support system as well, and I was able to cheer them on. But again, it was something that I've always been used to, and I have the mindset of it could always be worse, and the cancer that I've survived is extremely rare to survive. So I thought, you know what, I'm here for a reason. I've met other people who are similar than I have, so why not be a positive role model to showcase that they're not alone and they have someone who can be a positive impact, just like I have that positive family. I also want to be a positive part of their life to help them showcase resiliency as well.
Well, it's absolutely exceptional. You know what really blew me away is that you also won the Miss Teen New York International.
Yes.
I mean, so you're good looking on top of everything.
So
you got,
thank you.
You strive, you endured, you're good looking. I mean, is there any deficiency here? I mean, you're probably the envy of a lot of people.
Thank you. My goal with being, you know, doing the pageant was to showcase that, or break the stereotypes with pageantry, because the one that I did, you have to have a platform where you speak about something you're passionate about throughout your whole entire year as the winner, if you were to win. So I wanted to talk about neurofibromatosis awareness and loving your body for who you are, because again, with the invisible disorder, you can't see all my tumors, yes, but I'm also covered in scars. My left arm has scars all over it. I have scars along my back from when I had a spinal fusion. So I made sure that when I wore my dress that you could see that I have these scars to showcase that, you know, you don't have to be perfect to win a pageant. It's about being an inspiration, and really showcasing that you want to be a change agent. So that was my overall goal.
Well, that is the most beautiful thing I've ever heard in my whole life.
Thank you.
It is absolutely beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Well, also, you did endure 10 surgeries. I mean, and there was one moment where I understand your vocal cords were paralyzed for 6 months. Well, what did you do?
Yeah,
did you point to things? You couldn't verbalize.
It was very difficult to verbalize. I always joke around because, you know, I like to try to make light of the situation, but I say that I sounded like E.T. and Batman combined. It was very raspy. I had to press on my throat to be able to get some words out. But most of the time it was a lot of writing things down and, yes, pointing. My mom could pick up on things that I wanted, but I did 6 months of speech therapy, and we still don't know how my vocal cords are working again. I know the left vocal cord is still partially paralyzed, but I can talk, so that's great. But it was from one of the cancer removals that I have from the stress of the surgery with being intubated and then the tugging and pulling that they had to do with the muscles around my throat. That's how it was paralyzed. But it's one of those things, again, where I'm so fortunate and thankful to have my voice back. So that's why I try to be positive, because, you know, I was told I wasn't going to get that back, and here I am now talking with you. So that's great.
Yeah, well, you are evidently a miracle, and a living miracle, which is really unbelievable. So what are you studying now? What are you doing now? How have you developed and evolved your life?
Of course. So I've always been passionate about psychology and helping children and families. Initially, I wanted to become a child life specialist, and as someone who helps children cope with chronic illnesses in a hospital setting or in at-home settings as well. But while I'm still so passionate about that, I realized, you know, when I'm working and volunteering in a hospital, it was hard on my days off to go into a hospital myself for treatment. So I thought I shouldn't spend my whole life in a hospital, but how can I still inspire and help other individuals? So now I'm studying school counseling at New York University, where my goal is to ensure that students with chronic health needs who have to study at home for surgeries or things like that can still receive an equal education and feel a part of the school setting, while also using drama therapy in a school setting as well to cope with arts. And that's just something I'm so passionate about, is helping children and families and making sure that they can have an equal or normal life as possible. While it might be different, but allowing them to have opportunities just as any so-called able-bodied person would be able to.
Mm-hmm. That's really very compelling. What made you recognize that this was a goal you wanted to achieve?
From having so many surgeries, I was often at home, and while I did have a good support system with my school setting, I often felt alone and felt that I wasn't able to do certain things that other students would, you know, homecoming. At one point, I wasn't allowed to attend just because I was so ill, and I just wanted to feel a part of the school, even though I was still a student at this school, but I just couldn't physically be there. And I want other students to have more opportunities than what I had at that time.
And so how do you see that being translated into a future? So I guess when you were studying, you attended school. What did you do it through, like a Zoom or some other form of technology? How did you evolve your time in learning?
This was definitely difficult, and it's something that I'm still actually trying to advocate for. So, unfortunately, I was not allowed to Zoom in. It's something about the other students' rights to privacy, so we weren't allowed to do that. And so I would have a tutor actually come home and help me. So that's kind of why I felt not a part of the school setting, because I wasn't able to physically see my teachers. And I understand, you know, the other students do have the right to their privacy, but now with the pandemic, this has opened up so many gateways of Zoom and things like that, and I'm hoping that now students with special needs that do have to stay home can have an opportunity to utilize Zoom even after the pandemic, because while the pandemic is coming to an end, chronic illnesses, they don't usually come to an end, so chronic illnesses don't stop, so why should their education and the opportunity to physically see their teachers? Because I know online, it's hard for a lot of people, but when it's your only option because you have a chronic illness, it's the best thing to have Zoom, because I would have loved to have Zoom instead of having a tutor. And I know that's silly because I should be thankful for the tutor, and which I am, but it's still different when you're able to actually see your teacher and some of the other students. You feel more included. So I'm hoping that I can contact legislators and individuals of a higher system where I can explain the importance of still ensuring that students with chronic needs are able to see their teachers, even if it is from a platform like Zoom.
Yeah, well, I think that because we're hopefully getting out of this pandemic, even though there are new variants that are somehow mutating and becoming viable in a derogatory way, and people are getting sick from it. I guess the thing that's interesting is that we will be marrying this new technology, and it's become acceptable after over a year's worth of time struggling with the teaching process and city council meetings or other meetings that it becomes important to be able to maybe not physically touch, but to see the faces and to see the expressions and to enjoy the interaction that way. And like you said, it's compelling because that's your life, and we wouldn't want it abridged in any way. So it's a wonderful concept. And I think it is being more and more acceptable, isn't it?
Yes,
you find
I think
that
it
it's
is
not,
too.
Or you do?
I do.
Okay,
I do
then
find
that's
it
great.
Is, yeah.
Wow.
Yes, it is. I agree.
And then what? So how do you do you have difficulty walking or anything like that, or are you able to travel from here to there? Whether it be to a museum or to a school or anything else, or
right.
That's too difficult at the moment because
so
maybe
right now,
you're concerned about illness.
Right, there are days where it is harder to get out of bed, in which my muscles, because my muscles are impacted with these tumors, so it's more so of a pain situation where it is hard to, you know, go to from point A to point B. I'll cancel.
Uh-huh.
Back when I felt more comfortable going into public, and now I'm starting to, but I would cancel events with friends just because I was so sore. But I do want to say that I am fortunate enough where my tumors are not in my lower extremities, so they're not in my legs. So that I am fortunate, so I can walk. I'm not in a wheelchair. It's more so that my joints or my muscles will get sore, but I do deal with pain tumor-wise on the upper part, so my arm, my neck, my spine, things like that. So I do, there are days where I am in pain, but again, I am fortunate enough that I don't have any tumors in my legs at this time.
So how do you compensate for, I guess, is it your muscles are atrophying on the upper part of your body? So is that difficult for you to, I guess after a night's sleep, it might be difficult to wake them up again, all the muscles and your capacity to move? Or is it just simply a pain that you remove from your mind somehow during the day, but it comes to haunt you when it's time to wake up?
Right. It's definitely a little bit of both. I actually notice my pain is stronger when it's time to go to bed, and I think it's because, you know, I've been moving all day, and now I'm finally relaxing. I can feel it all. And there's
right.
not a lot of medications that even take away my pain, which is something I've noticed a lot of NF patients deal with. We always say pain. That's the number one thing. We just want a relief from all this pain. Nothing we do gets rid of this pain. But I'm actually on a clinical trial, and I've been on it for almost 2 years now. I've been almost 2 years in November it'll be. And my tumors
uh-huh.
have actually shrunk over 23%, and my pain, while it is
really?
Still there, has decreased. Yes, so before when we were talking about muscles and things like that atrophying, my muscles and my bones were being eaten away by these tumors that my left elbow was constantly dislocating. I couldn't pick up a piece of paper or things like that without it dislocating, and now it hasn't dislocated in over a year, which that's incredible for me because I was going to a point where it was dislocating about twice a week. And so it's exciting to know that while I do have this pain, it has decreased, and my quality of life is improving because of this clinical study.
That is truly amazing. So you mean just simply lifting your hand or a piece of paper, which doesn't weigh a lot, it was
yeah.
just the movement of your arm that caused the dislocation in your at the elbow?
Yeah, so what was happening is the tumors were growing in between my elbow joint, and the tumors were obviously
uh-huh.
putting these little holes in my bones,
yeah.
and you could say eating away at my muscles. So, yeah, nothing was really holding my elbow joint in place.
That is amazing. So this new medication or treatment that you're undergoing now for almost 2 years, that's relieved it to some extent? Well, certainly
it
not
has,
the
yeah.
dislocation has been relieved or put to the side. How do you maintain such a vigorous, energetic, engaged attitude? You seem to be more vibrant in so many ways that people who may have a different life seem not to recognize I guess all the facilities that they have at their disposal, and yet you, having some shortfalls, are able to overcome all of those things, and you find positiveness in so much of what you do, and even the goals, you know, becoming a Miss Teen New York, that's phenomenal. And it's so exciting. I don't know how you find the strength to even think about this sort of stuff. So your world is very open,
it can be hard.
It?
It is.
Yeah.
Again, for me, I'm the only person in my family that has this disorder. So I was actually diagnosed at 2 months of age, but everything kind of started to, you know, develop more when I was two. That's when I started taking blood pressure medicine for my kidneys and things like that. But so I'm a spontaneous mutation, meaning I'm the only person in my family who has all this, you know, NF. So I say I'm the lucky one. I joke around just because that's how I stay positive. I say, you know, I'm like a character from X-Men. I'm a mutant. But no, I'm kidding. But I just try to stay positive. And the thing is, since I'm the only one that has NF in my family, while I know that they sympathize and empathize for me and they do anything to support me when I was younger, I felt that no one understood. I was like, why am I the only one who has these tumors? And I when I was younger, I would say, why did God do this to me? What did I do wrong? And I met other people who had NF, and I saw that how positive and so strong they were. And they also have been through so much. And I want to say I was 8 years old. It was my first NF symposium. And I thought, why am I complaining? They have been through so much. And, you know, I can sit here and be negative and just continue to let the negativity come back, or I can be positive and inspire others. And seeing how I'm helping others, it would bring so much light into my world. So from that moment with my first NF symposium and meeting others that actually I understood the pain and the agony that I go through is what inspired me. So I believe that if we put positivity out into this world, we're going to get positivity back. And ever since, that's what I try to do. And I do have my negative days where I'm, of course, in pain and just want the pain to stop. But I always try to help others because, again, I want to be a positive agent. And I believe that if I put positivity out, I'm going to get positivity back.
So evidently, based on what I've just heard you say, so there are times when you have a bout with almost like a depression or a, I guess a loathing of your circumstance, but you're able to get beyond that, which I don't know if people have that capacity. It's not an easy capacity to gain or to become self-educated to overcoming your body's propensity not to function as you would want it to. But I wonder if that, in a sense, is also the gift that gave you so much knowledge and so much awareness of yourself and what you could do with your life. I mean, I don't want to make it seem like, oh, this is a gift, you know, like getting a birthday gift or something like that.
No.
I mean, it's a circumstance that you've been able to overcome. It is unbelievable what you've done.
I'm literally
overwhelmed.
Thank you. And again, it stems from being fortunate. You could say a gift of having a great family and the Children's Tumor Foundation. You know, that's how my mom was able to find the NF symposiums and able to work with other individuals and find them who are similar as I am. So I'm so thankful for my whole family and the Children's Tumor Foundation.
And so did I get it right? Do you have some siblings as well?
I do. I have so many brothers. I have two brothers
so many?
Who are twins. I do. I'm the oldest. I have two. I have two brothers who are twins, and then I have two more younger brothers. So four boys.
Boy, a big family. My God.
I know. They're all so great. They're all so supportive. They're amazing.
That's really great. I think I can't imagine that one can survive what you're going through and thrive despite what you're going through without such a support system. You must have exceptionally wonderful, wonderful parents that have been able to instill that in you, but also your brothers. So the support system is very, very pertinent. And then how do you find other people that have been diagnosed with NF? How did they function? Are they functioning like you, or are they still struggling with not knowing how to contend with the crises of any particular day or a time in their life? Can you teach things to people because you've already gone through it?
Right. So I know we have different, you know, Facebook forums where we could see a bunch of people who have NF. And again, with NF, everyone, like any other disorder, everybody has different views and different spectrums of their NF and different ways how it affects them, whether it's, you know, more internal or if it's more external tumors. Mm. And again, I think it depends on the support system that they each have had. So, and their location or where they live, do they have access to a good medical care system? Because where I live in upstate New York, not a lot of people know about NF, so I travel to Boston for my treatment. So I think that's also a big factor. So with CTF, they have these different places on their website where you can meet others that have NF, so they're able to connect. Like CTF is definitely the glue that allows people to meet other individuals where you can go on NF walks to raise awareness and funds for disorders, this disorder, so you can, you know, go on clinical studies like I am, because that's, we need that funding. It's so important. But again, with CTF, you're able to connect and join different Facebook groups. And I, you know, social media can be a hit or miss, but it is also so positive in that other individuals with NF are able to see each other virtually and meet each other virtually.
Mm, that's amazing. So how do you find the medical staff? They must be really phenomenal people. These are exceptional people, I would think.
Yes, definitely. So again, I know I keep talking about CTF, but on their website, you can go to this little section. It's like a map, and it'll say where you live, and it'll help you find specialists that can help you. And for myself, whenever someone is commenting, is there a place that, you know, if they're willing to travel, especially, do you think this person would see me? And I always suggest Boston Children's, because I've been going there since I was two, and they know my whole care system. They've always been a great, again, support system for me, and I've had every single surgery that I've had has always been at Boston Children's, besides one, but it was just my getting my appendix removed. But even then, I was willing to go to Boston if I had to. But no, all of my procedures regarding my disorder, and I'm always followed at Boston Children's Hospital. And I know I'm not a child anymore, but once you're a children's patient, you're always it.
Absolutely. And then, so what are your goals now? Unfortunately, we don't have that much time, only about 3 minutes
or
so.
Okay.
What are your goals now? What are you looking to do? What are you striving for? What are the challenges you face?
Right. So right now my health is doing well. Like I said, I'm on a clinical study. It's working. I should be graduating from New York University, my master's in school counseling, by the end of May of next year. And my goal is
nice.
To continue advocacy. Thank you. And I would love to one day become a public spokesperson professionally as a career or a motivational speaker. So that's definitely a goal of mine, and continuing my love for theater.
Well, I'm impressed by your capacity to speak. I wish I had your capacity to speak so well and so eloquently. I just want to thank you for making the time. It's so relevant to just hear your voice and to be able to recognize what you've gone through, and that your goals are not stunted in any way. You've got grand goals, and I'm sure that you'll be able to accomplish everything you've set your mind to do. It's truly amazing.
Thank you so much. I truly appreciate
you.
Be,
well, I appreciate you right back. I'm the one that's impressed. I'm really, rarely, there was one other gentleman I remember about a year ago that I don't remember exactly what he was suffering from, but he was also just an exceptionally, there was a heart to him that was there, and
right.
And he didn't make an issue out of it. He just was, you know, and it was so evident. So it's rare to find people like you anywhere in life. So you're a blessing, and I thank you for making the time. I hope you'll consider coming back. I hope I didn't frighten you.
No, I would love to come back.
Well, we'll have to do that. I'll definitely stay in touch.
Sounds great. Thank
Listen,
you so,
all the
so
best
much.
To you. Enjoy the 4th of July. Have fun.
Thank you. You too.
And keep up the good work.
I will. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I hope you enjoy your day.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Back to you as well.
Thank you.
All right, folks. What a pleasure. Brianna Warden. She's only 23 years old. She just recently graduated Boston University. And that's the least of her accomplishments. And I guess life is her accomplishment, which is absolutely a thrill. And she's been doing this, I think, since the age of 2, when she was informed that life was going to be a little bit different. And she's made the best of it. I don't think I've ever spoken to anyone as eloquent as she in all the years that I've been living. And I'm almost 50 years older than she. So really terrific. What a great way of meeting someone. And thank goodness for the phones. So bear with me a moment, because I know we'll soon be speaking, and he may already be on. We're going to be speaking with Seth David Radwell. He's a business leader. He's got a master's degree in public policy from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And he's written a book called American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. And evidently, he has researched that the political divisions within the United States that we see today are not unprecedented. And so his book is what explains the dynamic. So let's just see. Oh, he's already on, so let's bring him in. Good morning.
I'm here.
Sir. Thank you for calling. Thank you.
Good morning, Hezzy. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yeah, absolutely. What a pleasure for your making the time. I'm really thrilled about your concept. What made you even consider studying this dynamic that has divided our nation? And we're still divided. But you say that there's a historical perspective that we have forgotten about, that you have uncovered or you always knew about. What
well,
is
yes,
that
I
history?
Mean, sure, Hezzy. The concept is, and what drove me to this endeavor over the past couple of years was watching how my colleagues of mine from business and in my personal life were, to some degree, putting their head in the sand and allowing and watching as our political discourse collapsed, which was extremely painful to me personally. So I embarked on this journey of extensive research, and to answer your question, I feel like we're currently, in today's time, we're stuck in two bubbles, two prisons, if you will. One is the partisan prison that we, the partisan bubble which we each live in, which is based on what we selectively decide to tune into, so to speak. And the second bubble is a time bubble. And I precisely went back to research the roots of our divisions because I believe that, and I still firmly believe that, without the historical perspective of how we got to where we are, it's very hard to have the ability to break out of it, to have a perspective longitudinally over our history to understand where the roots of our divisions come from. So what the book is an intent, the book's a journey and an endeavor to help us basically find a new way of creating, rehabilitating our political dialogue that's in a much more productive manner. And I feel this is vital. I believe that the last couple of years, our democracy is at risk, and as our political discourse collapses and is crowded out by rancor and anger, we're going nowhere, and it's getting more and more difficult. So that's why I started this endeavor.
And what did you find from the historical perspective that you've studied? Is our divide all based on money? Is there a difference between the red and the blue? And is it all about money, or is it something else? what's driving the equation, and is it the same? Is it a replication of what happened maybe 200 years ago?
It's absolutely not unprecedented. It's a replication of themes we've seen for many years. But the difference, Hezzy, is that today the dialogue, the discussion is extremely superficial and is driven by irrationality. And what I found was when you go back and understand where the divisions in America lie, it's about different visions that the country was birthed around in the Enlightenment period. And these divisions were quite fundamental and are really important to understand. So my challenge to your listeners and to readers is to kind of resist the urge to lash out and critique the other side and be a bit more reflective and a little bit more investigative and analytical about why we're here. And the reason why this is so important to me is because it's about fundamentally being able to hand off a democracy as a form of government to our children. As I was inspired by Jana on the previous segment. What an incredibly bright, wonderful young lady who's been through so much. Well, those next generations of Americans, unbelievable. Those next generation Americans, we want to make sure that we're handing them their Enlightenment heritage of a democracy, of a government of the people. And from what I've seen over the past 4 years, but really even further than that, the past 15, 20 years in terms of what's happened, how our discourse has devolved, we're not on a good track to do that. So while not unprecedented, we need to understand the precedents and the background and the history to overcome our dilemmas today.
Well, we don't have that discourse, do we? Are we just
not
so
at
adversarial
all.
That we can't get beyond the tree that's right in front of our face, and we don't see that there's a much larger forest here, and we're not engaged in civil discourse, and we're not taking on the big issues, and we don't want to be challenged by anything that's adversarial in any way, shape, or form? And have we devolved to the point where personalities have espoused just dogma rather than a rational perspective of where we should be and where we need to go and how to get there? We don't seem to be helping each other.
Not at all. The way I describe it is 77% of America, based on research, is part of what I call an exhausted majority, meaning they're completely fed up and frustrated by the way the left and the right, both extremes, dominate the conversation and apparently are the only ones that get a voice, because those 77%, the exhausted majority, actually believe that we have more in common than drives us apart. And so there's a pathway, there's a way to give voice back to those 77% of Americans. And that's what my book goes into in some detail. A part of the secret, I mean, there's really three parts to the secret, which, again, American Schism discusses in some length. One part of the secret is recognizing that we are in these bubbles, which are really prisons, because they're self-imposed. We've chosen mobs, part of what I call our in-group, to give us validation and to supercharge the endorphin rush we get when we attack our out-group. And you know, this kind of identity politics, sometimes it's called, it's driven by primitive responses that served the human species very well in millennia ago, because it had to do with survival. It's that amygdala-driven knee-jerk reaction we all feel, that endorphin rush that we associate with sports. You know, if we're in a sports arena, we know how it feels. What I'm saying is that is wonderful for cheering on sports teams. It's no way to make public policy. And one of the secrets that the book goes into in the last section is about how we have to reject our knee-jerk impulses to play this game, and we should save it for the sports arena.
Well, yes, we should save it for the sports arena, that's for sure. But then, your book, American Schism, speaks to that whole issue. So we need to evolve something that would function and be inclusive. And yet at the same time, We're not seeing that. We're seeing greater and greater division. People are stuck in whatever dogma they believe in. They're not looking for a relationship or a discussion. And who is creating this need or desire to show us a new road? Or have we built the new road yet and we just don't have enough people on it?
Yeah, so that's kind of the whole reason for this book. So I believe that, first of all, I want to make it clear to your listeners that I'm not saying we shouldn't have different points of view. Our democracy has thrived on divergent points of view over the course of our history, and we've always had disagreements about how the U.S. should function. So divergent views are important, but if we reject objective truth altogether, if we reject reason completely, then democracy as a form of government is doomed. So the call to action, if you will, is to get on a different road. And I believe this will only come by both, you know, top-down efforts and bottom-up efforts. So by top-down efforts, I think our leaders, we need leadership both civically and in government and society that will embrace our Enlightenment heritage of truth, objective truths and rationality and facts. But we also need, besides the top-down, we need bottom-up efforts to get those 77% of Americans, the exhausted majority, who feel they have no voice, that who feel their voice has been crowded out by the extreme left and right, we have to get those Americans to not be afraid to speak up. We have to get them to not put their head in the sand, and we have to give them a voice. And that's my American Schism, and the research that I've done over these last few years is one of those bottom-up endeavors. I'm trying to get people to see that there is another way. And I believe we all have to, you know, most of my business colleagues, and I speak about this sometimes with friends, and these are very smart, intelligent people who've been very successful, Hezzy. I've watched over the past couple of years, as the political dialogue has gotten more and more insane, most of them have put their head in the sand. They focus on their business and their families, which is understandable. We all have immediate concerns in our lives, and they're trying to pursue their success, and I don't blame them. But what I'm saying to my colleagues is we've got to speak up about this, because if we keep our head in the sand as the 77% and let the 23% on the two ends, on the two extremes, dominate the conversation, where democracy is doomed. I think that the media models in place today, by the way, which we can get into in more detail if you want to, are, of course, incentivized to give voice to those fringes. And that's part of the problem.
Well, I think that we're very balanced in what we do, but we're a small operation in comparison to the big boys, you know, like the New York Times or the Washington Post or the New York Post or USA Today. But they take sides, and they don't explain the differences between the divisions, and so
yes.
And they don't speak up. They seemingly are afraid. Maybe they're going to lose advertisers, or who knows what it is that's driving them. But have we lost that sense of just doing the right thing? Are we so afraid to speak up? And do we have people that will speak up for us? And I know in the media, quite often, there's a lot of stuff that's going on, and the media does not report it.
Right.
And it's a very, very difficult situation. And our political leaders don't stand up even when they're in the middle of the road. So
I don't know how we bring this forward. Well, that's what the book describes, a path to do that. And
right.
I would say that Hezzy, your program is an example of part of the solution, not the problem, and that this is a program that discusses issues in depth and in nuance. Part of when I say the media model is a problem, I'm talking about social media and to some degree broadcast and cable media that are feeding into sensationalism. Because the truth is no issue is black or white. For example, let's take one current issue that's in the vernacular, that's in the debate today, around, and it's been very active for the past couple of years, the issue on immigration. So, you know, it's not about building walls and opening borders. So both sides, the extreme sides of the immigration, what I call the immigration debate, love to characterize. I'm sorry, what's the word I'm looking for? Make a caricature. Yes, make a caricature of the other side. But the truth is, I don't think any logical person who studies the facts believes that we should either open the borders completely, or nor should we separate children from their parents and put up walls. We need a logical framework for immigration. So what happens is, in the dialogue, both sides, to garner support, use impulses to demonize the other side. And the tragedy, as we hear, if we stick with this example for a second, and I go into some detail on this in the book, we were very close to a whole new framework for immigration that the Gang of Eight on the Hill came up with in 2013. It was embraced by both sides of the aisle, and it had what today has become a dirty word. It had compromises, which is you know, not everyone got what they want. There was a pathway to citizenship for people who've been here, the Dreamers, as we now call them. There were other restrictions on immigration to make sure that it didn't become overwhelming to any individual part of the states. So what I'm saying is that the solutions that were on the table were really intriguing and were based in rational, fact-based analysis. Whereas now, if we fast forward, 8 years, we're much further away from any solution because we've embraced, or many of us have embraced, this demonic form of dialogue where we hate the other side. And gun control would be the gun ownership and gun regulation would be another example where most Americans, 80% of Americans, believe that crazy people should not have access to guns. Not, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that, right? But, and in fact, if you go deeper, and there are a couple of resources which I talk about in the book, but The Politics Industry by Catherine Hale and Michael Porter shows why our political systems are so focused on keeping themselves in power and keeping this form of dialogue, this extreme dialogue, going. And another, there's a group called More in Common, which is a nonprofit organization that's done a lot of research that shows that, for example, on gun ownership, even gun owners are very much embrace logical regulations to stop guns getting in the hands, or semi-automatic weapons getting in the hands of the wrong people. So Americans agree on this. So if we agree on it, why can't we come up to a public policy solution? It's really extremely frustrating.
It is very, it's very, very frustrating for sure. But the public either are not informed, are not expressive in their perspectives. They fall into line with whatever is said on a Fox News station on a liberal station. And, they become mobs on both sides. Yeah.
Correct.
And
there's a... Yes.
So who's going to bring us to a form of enlightenment? Not that you have to go one way or the other, but we've been built on, it's a nation that's been built on diversity, in infusion of ideas. It's got all the answers, and that's been our strength. Have we lost that? Or is there still room to find it again?
There is absolutely room to find it again. And there's a reason, Hezzy, why this book refers to the Enlightenment. Because in fact, the Enlightenment is the period in history when it was recognized broadly that humans have an incredible capacity for two things, for empirical observation and for reason. And those capabilities which were recognized, those elements of human capacity which were recognized in the 18th century, actually is what created the modern world. So let me take us on a little bit of a journey for your listeners for a second. If I say the Enlightenment today is a bad word, we don't like to use that term. And let me put it this way: 200 years ago, humans survived till 31 years. That was life expectancy. Today, it's over 70 years across the globe. 200 years ago, one in five children didn't survive till age five. Today, almost all do. 200 years ago, four-fifths of the world population lived in extreme poverty. Today, one-fifth of the world's population lives in that level of poverty. Now, all of these, the point being, in 200 years, we have made more progress in human prosperity than in the prior 2,000 years. Now, much of this is due to our inheritance from the Enlightenment, from the fact that great thinkers a couple of hundred years ago started understanding that life wasn't only organized around religion and the birth lottery about who was born a king or a noble, but it was about human beings able to make use of their God-given capacities for reason and for learning. That is what, in fact, birthed our nation. So the book, the reason why the book focuses on the Enlightenment is very clear when you take that perspective. Now, what I will say is that in the last 50 years, there's this movement that dismisses the Enlightenment. It's part of what sometimes is called the postmodern movement, that, you know, the Enlightenment was a bunch of white European men who were right. They didn't really have as much of an influence as we think. But I think that's an entirely misguided view. The Enlightenment, first of all, it was not only men, although it was largely men who were the educated people of their age. They unleashed what is today the modern society. And we need to go back to your earlier question about how do we get on a path to get away from this incredibly destructive discourse that we have today. The way we do it is by embracing our Enlightenment heritage. We focus on data and observation and rational debate, which is what the Enlightenment recognized. And so that's why the book goes back to the Enlightenment. It understands why when our country was formed, there were actually different schools of thought about the Enlightenment. That's why it's called two Enlightenments. There was a moderate Enlightenment and a radical Enlightenment, and those differences were in fact very relevant and are still underlying some of our divisions today. So my belief is that in order to get on a better track, we need a bottom-up movement of Americans willing to break out of their partisan bubble and their time bubble. And in terms of the time bubble, I think we've got to look at the ideals that formed our nation and that have allowed us to be successful in so many ways, despite terrible moments and eras of violence. I mean, we haven't had, by far, a peaceful existence. To a large degree, our history has been one of gaining enfranchisement for different groups of Americans who originally were left out of the promise of the Declaration of Independence. But your understanding of exploring that journey is extremely important.
Definitely. So are we righting the wrongs, or we just don't really know which way we're going at the moment? It seems that our fabric as a nation has been ripped apart. But yet,
well,
there's some vestiges
that
maybe things are working better. Sorry.
Yes, no, I'm sorry. I interrupted you, Hezzy. Well, look, when you watch the news that we talked about, and I'm not talking about local radio. I'm talking about sometimes when you watch national news or cable, you think that the world, that it's doomsday, that, you know, everything is falling apart. We've had incredible challenges, whether it's COVID-19, whether it's the climate crisis. We certainly have problems. But the irony is that we're not going to solve those problems by continuing this unreasoned debate. We have to have a different type of debate. We have to fight unreason with reason, as I say in the book. And that's the mission that I'm on, to help Americans realize that there's a better way.
Well, can Americans open their eyes and become engaged in voting? It seems a lot of people are not voting. And I think that's been one of the major pillars of strength of the nation. And people have become so complacent that the dogma, whatever side, left or right, is running the show.
Correct.
And,
I think voting is part of it, but also civic education. I mean, I think we've abandoned the notion of – so, for example, the last 30 years, you know, the focus on STEM education has been science, technology, math, all very important, and all all important skills to be able to be a productive member of society. So there's an understanding why education has moved. But here's the secret. The radical enlighteners, especially the French enlighteners, understood that the only way to have a representative democracy is to have an educated populace. And if we don't educate our young people in what used to be called civics, but it's not just one class in civics. It's about understanding how to evaluate an argument, how to communicate eloquently, as Brianna Worden just did, your prior guest. You know, we used to have in school debate clubs. We need to be able to evaluate data to see how truthful we think it is and critically view it. So what I'm saying is that those skills, and again, it's not one civics class, it's a whole way of thinking. Those skills are necessary if we want to have a government of the people. And, if we prefer to have autocracy or government of the few or of one, or what's turning into in the States more of a plutocracy because the wealthy have so much control over the levers of government, then that's a decision we might make.
Well, do we know yet how to teach deductive reasoning? Because that seems to have gone out the window maybe 50 years ago.
Absolutely. I think part of the solution, it is refocusing on what would be called broad liberal education. And we have to get back to a focus on that. And by the way, it's not only one of content, it's one of access. One of the great achievements of modern America was the degree to which public education had become so powerful and so influential. And we've lost a lot of that. There's a great there's tremendous inequality in access to education, and that I think that is also has to be addressed. That's part of what I go into to some degree in the third part of the book when I put together a portfolio of what I think are potential solutions to what's happened in America today.
Well, it's really very interesting when you take the whole panoply of items that have come about. Did my generation, which goes back, to the 50s, did our teachers at that time, did they start to fail? Because I think I got a greater education from my parents who had a different background, and I saw that the teaching staff was not the way it used to be. So it was amazing. Well, it looks like we've been changing our teaching in the United States the last 50 years.
What I discuss in American Schism is it's a reflection of priorities. If we put our and make a priority, if we understand the power and reach of education, broad liberal civic education, in addition to STEM education, which of course is so important. And if we provide better access to that, that's a priority that we as a society have to make a decision about. I think a lot of education as a priority, once again, has been crowded out by other elements or other priorities which may be less important. So this is discussed in great detail in the book, and I believe that it's something that needs to be discussed in detail.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of the broadcast. Any last concepts that you wanted to bring out that I wasn't smart enough to ask?
Well, you asked great questions. You asked great questions. I would be happy to come discuss the book further, because the book goes into some specific journeys which are quite fascinating in their own right. But what I would say to your listeners
is, I would love that.
Yeah, I would be happy to come back.
I would love that very, very much.
That
would really be phenomenal.
Great. We'll talk about that. To your listeners, I would just ask one thing. Please, even though it feels good to attack the other side, or please reject that approach. Understand that listening and embracing truth and data are God-given capacities, and we should embrace them if we want to get to a better place in our civic discourse than we are today.
Well, that's the whole thing. I think people don't look at a situation and look for a resolution. They decide to go one way or the other, and they don't find, they don't search for that melding capacity, which does exist. It's just that it's difficult. Unfortunately, we don't have enough time, but I'd like people to remember to pick up your book, American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. It's published by the Greenleaf Book Group, and you could find it on Amazon and other bookstores as well. And what a pleasure. And I will call you back. It would be a thrill to discuss it even further.
I would love that. It's been a pleasure for me to be here and to be able to share this with your listeners. I'd love to come back.
Thank you so much, sir. All the best to you.
Have a wonderful day.
Seth David
and thanks
Radwell.
For the inspirational
thank
work
you
that you do. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, sir. Bye. So there we have it, folks. Seth Radwell, Seth David Radwell, American Schism. You might find it interesting as the great introduction by Mr. Radwell. So I'm thrilled to pieces. And we will really need to go back and talk to him further. Well, that's the end of our day today. We'll speak to you tomorrow. All the best. Take care. Goodbye.